This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You may know my guest, David McCullough, for his work hosting the PBS series Smithsonian World and The American Experience. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his biography of Truman. A few years ago, he set out to write a book about the relationship between founding fathers Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. As he got deeper into the research, he realized that Adams' papers and his correspondences with his wife Abigail were much more forthcoming than Jefferson's writings, and that Adams was a more sympathetic figure than historians often portrayed him. So McCullough changed his project into a biography of John Adams. It's just been published. McCullough describes Adams as the person who did the most to drive the Declaration of Independence through the Continental Congress in 1776. He served as vice president under George Washington and was elected the second president of the United States. His son, John Quincy, was the sixth president. I asked McCullough why Adams was so determined to have the colonies win their independence from England, even though he knew that the fight for independence would be long and bloody.
He almost alone of all those of that time saw that it was going to be a long, costly, and bloody war. He thought it would last 10 years. As it turned out, it lasted 8 years, so he wasn't very far off. Many people, Jefferson among them, thought it would all be over quite quickly and that we would win rather easily. Which, of course, was worse than wishful thinking. He believed that we must have independence because he believed that independence was the only way we would have freedom. When they say free and independent, the free is dependent on the independence. We must be independent of all other foreign powers, including the mother country, if you will, Great Britain, in order to attain the kind of freedom that they envisioned, that they demanded.
What were the ways in which he felt the British were intruding on his personal freedoms and his personal life and the lives of the people he was closest to?
He felt that the British were intruding on their personal lives by and the lives of people in his community, in his own family, by taxation, by the occupation, presence in Boston of British troops, which he took to be an insult, and of course for which they were being taxed in order to cover the cost. He felt that the fundamental rights of an English citizen were being violated. It wasn't that he wanted to attain something beyond what an Englishman's rights were considered to be. He wanted to hold on, as did so many of that time, hold on to what they felt was the basic way of life, the basic freedom that his forebears had achieved, both as English subjects and by establishing a new way of life, a new country of a kind on this side of the Atlantic. Remember, he's a fourth-generation citizen of Massachusetts. Many people somehow don't remember or know that, appreciate that the country, the settlement of this country was long before the Revolutionary War. Also, that the Revolutionary War began more than a year before the Declaration of Independence. Very important to understand. It wasn't that the Declaration of Independence then ignited a war. War had already ignited. So by the time they're at Philadelphia in 1776, a lot of blood has been spilled. And he had no misconceptions about the fact that the British intended to crush the American Revolution with force, with bloodshed, with power, and that anybody who thought otherwise was deluding themselves.
What did he tell his fellow members of the Continental Congress to convince them that it was important to have a revolution and to have a Declaration of Independence?
Well, he gave what was the greatest speech of his career, and the greatest speech given in the Continental Congress, and maybe one of the greatest and certainly one of the most important speeches ever given in American history. And we have no record of it. We really aren't sure what he said because no records were kept. Nobody was writing it down. It was all conducted behind closed doors in secrecy because of the very fear of Tories and spies in Philadelphia. But he was, in effect, saying that we must stand up for our liberties and we must join in this declaration because it's only through a declaration of independence from Britain, that is going to enable us to unite in spirit, that it will do wonders for the morale of our army, of our fighting forces. And it will guarantee, or perhaps it won't guarantee, it will certainly make it more likely that we can get support from abroad, namely from France. In other words, France, until we issued a declaration of independence, the chances of getting financial and even military support from France were going to be very, very slight. But once we broke away from England, once we declared our intention of breaking away from England, that support from France could well be forthcoming. The French weren't about to come in to help a revolution or an uprising that was on the verge of making accommodation. The French came in to support the American Revolution primarily. This is the French government, the King of France and his ministers, came into the American Revolution because it was a way of getting at England, of sticking it to England. They weren't in favor of representation, democratic representation. They didn't believe that all men were created equal, by no means. And their monarchy was, if anything, more rigid, more established, more less admirable than the monarchy of Great Britain.
On July 2nd, 1776, when the Constitutional Convention voted to accept the Declaration of Independence, John Adams wrote, "This will be the most memorable epoch in the history of America. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of this continent to the other, from this time forward forevermore." In a way, he's describing the 4th of July celebrations that have happened ever since.
Exactly. He's the only one who said that then. Now, that doesn't mean that others didn't feel it, and maybe they did. Maybe they felt it as much or more than he did. But they didn't say so. He said so in one of the hundreds of letters that he wrote to Abigail. There are more than 1,000 letters between them, and that is the kind of outpouring that appears frequently. And it's, of course, of great importance, and it suggests what kind of fervor was felt at the time. The 4th of July, which we celebrate now, he wouldn't have understood that. That was the date on the document itself, but the actual vote took place on the 2nd, and the signing of the Declaration of Independence didn't take place until later, on August 8th. And then, even then, not everybody signed. Many people weren't there. They were still signing it on into the fall and later on. And, in fact, there's very little record of what either Adams or Jefferson even did on July 4th.
After the Declaration of Independence, Adams' town of Braintree chose him as a delegate to the State Constitutional Convention. Now, the National Constitution had not yet been written. You describe this state constitution, the Massachusetts Constitution, as one of Adams' most admirable and longstanding achievements. And you also describe this constitution as being the longest functioning written constitution in the world. What kind of principles did he lay down in this constitution?
Well, he laid down essentially what our own national constitution stipulates, and he did so 10 years in advance of our national constitution. It did not, however, provide for freedom of religion. And years later, in his 80s, when there was a constitutional convention organized in Massachusetts to see what revisions would be necessary for the constitution of the state, Adams went and battled to make freedom of religion part of the Constitution and failed to succeed, and wrote to Jefferson that I must be getting old because I've lost my powers of persuasion. And he was very down about that. Jefferson applauded him for having the courage and the decency to go and fight for what was right. It has a Bill of Rights, like our Constitution. It sets up a structure, a three-part system of government, which is very similar to what we have now. The executive is the commander-in-chief. There is a legislature that's divided into a House and a Senate and so forth. And it has also in it, and I think this is so important, a clause or paragraph unlike that in any Constitution written before or since, in which he says, "It shall be the duty," and the key word is duty, "the duty of the government to provide education for everybody." And then he goes on to specify what he means by education. And what he says, in effect, is that by education I mean everything: agriculture, finance, art, the sciences, mathematics, literature, etc., etc. And that it shall be, again, the duty of this system of education to cherish literature and the arts. And it shall be the duty of education in the Commonwealth to encourage good spirit among the people and good humor among the people. It's an amazing paragraph, which he was quite proud of and which he was quite sure would not be passed by the legislature of Massachusetts. As it turned out, it was passed. It was not only passed, it was passed unanimously and is still part of the Constitution.
Now, in the Constitution that John Adams wrote, he wrote that all men were born equally free and independent, which isn't exactly the same as saying all men are born free and equal. Why did he object to the Jeffersonian idea of all men being born free and equal?
Well, Jefferson said all men are born, all men are born equal. Adams didn't believe that. He didn't believe we're all born equal, because he said all you have to do is look around and you can see that some people are born with more advantages than others. Some are stronger. Some are better looking. Some have the luck of being born into wealth advantages of all kinds. Some people are handicapped at birth. What he said and what he held to be his fundamental principle all of his life is that while all men may not be equal, they are all equal before the law and all equal in the eyes of God.
My guest is historian David McCullough. His new book is a biography of John Adams. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David McCullough, and his new book is a biography of John Adams. Adams was chosen as a minister to France during the Revolution. What was his role in negotiating the peace treaty that ended the Revolutionary War, which he helped to start?
He was one of three of our representatives at the peace treaty. Benjamin Franklin and John Jay were the two others. And they were, by European standards, neophytes as diplomats. They were untrained. No one from the United States was really trained as a diplomat, as were, say, the great diplomats of Europe. They had none of that background. They didn't see the world quite the same way. And one would assume, therefore, that they went into those negotiations and had been negotiating through the war with the handicap of being neophytes. But they did extremely well. In many ways, it was one of the most advantageous treaties that we ever signed. It was signed in Paris. It's known as the Treaty of Paris, 1783. And the most important of all achievements of the treaty was, of course, the independence of the country. The independent United States of America. And that its geographic terrain, its boundaries, reached to the Mississippi River, which was by no means certain before the treaty was signed, and it made it doubled the size of what the colonies had been, so that it was really had become an empire, a geographic presence of great importance just with the signing of that treaty.
He read the Constitution while he was in London serving as ambassador. He was critical about some parts of the Constitution. For instance, he wanted the president to have more power. Exactly what did he want for the president, and why did he want it?
Well, he believed in a strong executive, and he believed that the Constitution did not provide a strong enough executive office. He felt that that was the only way you were going to hold together these very different and disparate colonies, 13 colonies. Jefferson, by contrast, wanted a weaker presidency and more power in the legislature, and in this they differed. Adams also wanted a Bill of Rights. There was no, initially, as you know, no Bill of Rights. Jefferson, though he later said there should be a Bill of Rights, when he first read the Constitution, did not object to the fact that there was no Bill of Rights. Adams strongly endorsed the new Constitution and said so by letter to home. Jefferson was equivocal about the new Constitution. So I think those are the principal differences.
Adam said of Jefferson about the difference between the two of them, "You are afraid of the one, I of the few." We agree perfectly that the many should have full, fair, and perfect representation. You are apprehensive of monarchy, I of aristocracy. I would therefore have given more power to the presidency and less to the Senate. Can you describe that split a little bit more, why Adams felt that whereas Jefferson was afraid of monarchy, Adams was afraid of aristocracy?
Well, Jefferson was fearful that the presidency would become fixed, that it could lead to monarchy, that it could lead to a king. And, of course, that king was the only way that people had ever lived under. That was what everyone was accustomed to. And that the country might resort to that if things got difficult or contentious. Adams was more concerned about what he called the aristocracy, which he saw as being the Senate. And he was worried that there were certain people who would naturally gain control because they had more education, they had more money, they had more connections, influence, whatever one wishes to call it, and that the best way to control them was to contain them in the Senate. And when he talks about trusting the many, he's talking about the representation, the direct representation in the House. So he wanted a weaker Senate and a stronger executive. Jefferson was more inclined to the reverse.
Jefferson and Adams were partners in creating a revolution in America, and in writing the Declaration of Independence, or at least in conceiving the Declaration of Independence. Adams became the second president. Jefferson was his vice president. Then they ran against each other, and Jefferson won in that election. How did they end up becoming enemies after being such close partners?
Well, primarily because Jefferson made no effort to be of any help to Adams when Jefferson was serving as Adams' vice president. And because Jefferson was an ardent Republican, as they said then, the Republican Party of that time later became the Democratic Party of our time, and was very much involved with the politics of the Republican Party behind the scenes. And as it turned out, later on it was discovered that Jefferson had been paying the man who was attacking Adams most viciously in the press, the famous scandalmonger James Callender. And when that became known, it was crushing for Adams personally, that his friend had betrayed him. And Abigail really never forgave Jefferson for that. It's, I think, much to Adams' credit that Adams was willing to forgive. I'm not sure he ever forgot, but he certainly did forgive. And they had a reconciliation after they had each retired from the presidency, brought about through their mutual friend Benjamin Rush. And that's when the great correspondence between Jefferson and Adams commenced in 1812 and lasted until the end of their lives in 1825.
John Quincy Adams was the first son of a president to become a president. George W. Bush is the second. In the remaining minute that we have, any comparisons you could make?
Well, there are some comparisons. The father, in both cases, the father is very extremely fond of the son fond of the father. Both John Quincy and President Bush had strong mothers, to say the least. John Quincy and President Bush, had the benefit of a privileged education. Beyond that, the similarities begin to become less conspicuous. To say that George Bush Sr. and George W. Bush are not the equals of John Adams and John Quincy Adams is not quite fair. I'm not sure anybody today is the equal of John Adams and John Quincy Adams. They were two of the most brilliant human beings who ever became president. I think if you gave all the presidents of the United States an IQ test, that John Quincy Adams might come in first. He wasn't a particularly strong or effective president, but he was brilliant and maybe the best Secretary of State we ever had, a man of great humanity beneath what seemed to many a rather austere manner.
Any final thought you'd like to leave us with about John Adams?
Yes, I think that no one can really understand John Adams and the kind of human being he was without understanding his marriage and Abigail. She is the key not just to much of what life in that time was like, but what kind of idealism he followed. They were people of principle. I think one example of that is that John Adams was the only founding father who never owned a slave on principle. And Abigail was in full agreement with him on it.
Well, David McCullough, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
David McCullough is the author of a new biography of John Adams. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.